So if I talk about it anymore, I'm going to curse whoever's listening to you. So
you're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White.
Terry Brooks.
Sheena Kamal.
Matthew Quick.
J.T. Ellison.
Walt D. Williams.
Brad Ford.
Corey Doctorow.
Brandon Sanders.
Robin Mock.
Ernest Klein. Jim Butcher.
Sherwin Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
James Rollins.
Welcome to Author Stories. Find archives of all the shows at HankGarner.com, and while you're there, never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. It's free on all platforms. As we get into today's show, I'd like to tell you guys about some incredible new releases that I know you're going to love. The brand new book from Nathan Heistad, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. They've watched us for centuries through the Rift. They prepared. Invasion is inevitable. The Earth fleet has known of the Watchers for years, unwilling to share the knowledge with humanity. Now it might be too late. Hidden away from the fleet, one man is creating a new colony ship destined for the other side of the Rift, but he's missing a few pieces. Three other people have varied paths to get there. Ace goes from the streets of Earth to the fleet training facility on the moon. Flint, an ex-fleet pilot, must decide if a job is worth his life. And Wren, imprisoned for a secret project years ago, is given hope as an unlikely ally whispers words of escape in her ear. Their journeys lead to Councilman Jordan Fairbanks, who knows of the impending invasion and has prepared. All they can do is wait for the Rift to open once again and see what's on the other side. Rift joins an ensemble cast facing immeasurable obstacles. If you enjoy space battles, prison breaks, androids, and aliens, buried under a shroud of mystery, this book is for you. Try it today. A fresh new fiction adventure from the author of the best-selling Survivor series, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. Now available. There's a link in the show notes. Also from our friend Rick Partlow, Recon, A War of the Knife. Tyler Callis had a life most people would kill for. He killed to escape it. Tyler is the pampered heir of a high-level corporate council executive, groomed from birth to take a seat beside her as a member of the ruling class of the Commonwealth Society. But the bloody war with the alien Tani has hit close to home, and Tyler wants to join the military, something his powerful mother won't allow. Desperate to escape her control, Tyler changes his identity to Randall Monroe, a product of the poverty-stricken underground, and enlists in the Marines. There he flourishes, becoming a member of an elite force recon unit and striking deep behind enemy lines. But when his platoon is assigned to take back the colony on Demeter from the Tani, the mission falls apart. Most of his comrades are killed, and Monroe is wounded, separated from his unit and left for dead on an enemy-occupied world. With no other choice, he organizes the civilian colonists into a resistance movement and begins fighting against the occupation, with limited supplies and no support. As the situation becomes more and more desperate, what began as a high-tech interstellar conflict will become a war to the knife. Recon, A War to the Knife by Rick Partlow. There's a link to it in the show notes. Book 3 of the Saga of the Iron Dragon, the conclusion of the epic series that began with the Dream of the Iron Dragon. 9th century Iceland, three explorers from the far future have a daunting mission. To save humanity, they must build a craft capable of reaching the stars. The Voyage of the Iron Dragon is the concluding book in the Iron Dragon trilogy. The Iron Dragon trilogy is being produced as part of the phenomenally successful Saga of the Iron Dragon Kickstarter, which raised over $10,000. Meticulously researched and packed with action, The Dream of the Iron Dragon is a must for sci-fi and alternate history fans. Also, Book 2, The Dawn of the Iron Dragon, is available now from Audible.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have James Rollins back on the show with me. James was on the show last year in episode 275, and he has a brand new book out. When you're hearing this, it's available everywhere in hardback and audiobook and Kindle edition, and however you like to read books, you can get the new James Rollins thriller, Crucible. And I've had this book. I've had a pre-release copy for a couple of months now. I think it was right around Thanksgiving when it came out, and now I have the final release, and it is absolutely fantastic. James, you've done it again. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Hank. I appreciate it.
So last year, when your current book was out, then you came on the show and we talked all about it, and you gave us a little tease about some things you were working with for Crucible. How's it been going the last year, and how's the writing going on the next project?
Well, writing on the next project's going well. I hope to finish this in the next month or so. The next book deals with the mystery surrounding Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey, and some research into that's showing that there might be an unknown civilization that arose during that same period of time. So we'll be dealing with that in the next book.
Well, you know, the thing that I, or one of the things that I just absolutely love about your books is that you always find some interesting historical tidbit that maybe we've heard about, but we don't know the real story, or maybe some details about it that haven't really become mainstream. And then you combine that with some sort of what seems to be future tech, but cutting edge technology that's going on now. Tell us about Crucible, the new book that's out now. What were those catalysts that got the story moving for you?
Well, my books always have that sort of historical mystery. I'm always looking for those sort of interesting tidbits of history that either seem odd or end in a mystery, end in a question mark that I can play with in a novel. Then I'm looking for that science, you know, looking at what where we are right now with that science and what it might look like in the very near future and how that might pose a threat or how it might be a boon. And so for Crucible, it starts out with some mystery surrounding the great persecution of witches that occurred across Europe for centuries that preceded the Salem witch trials. A lot of weird little twists and turns to that history. You know, when Torquemada, who led the Spanish Inquisition, he was a bit of a bloody tyrant, led to the death of thousands of men and women. But over the centuries, the Spanish Inquisition became a little more liberal, became a little more tolerant. The witch burnings were on the decline. But there was sort of a hard kernel within that Inquisition that was not willing to let go of their core beliefs. And in fact, just became crystallized into almost a diamond-like hardness and brutality. And they christened themselves the Crucibellum, which is the Latin word for crucible, a vessel that purifies with fire. And they were sort of the core group that continued the persecutions during the later centuries of the Spanish Inquisition. And they were in direct opposition to the more liberal wing of the Spanish Inquisition that was trying to halt that. Now, what I found through my research, I learned about this group first from traveling through Spain, and that there's actually some corners of Spain that believe that the Crucibellum, this sort of hardcore inner circle, inner cabal of the Spanish Inquisition, is potentially still, you know, thriving as a sort of a dark secret society within different corners of Spain, and that they're still seeking to persecute heretics or women that dare question the natural order. So I found that intriguing. I could see how the past could influence the present with that group. But I also like the weird dichotomy between what the Catholic Church believed about witches. You know, there are witches that appear in the Bible, like the Witch of Endor that helps at a certain point in the Bible. There's also and again, that I learned in Spain was there actually is a Catholic patron saint for witches. It's Saint Columba. She was not a patron saint against witches. She was a patron saint for the protection of women, of witches. And to me, I found that fascinating. Here is the church was considered to be very anti-witch, yet they have a patron saint that protects witches. And so I just liked that dichotomy. So that was a little tidbit that ended up in my idea box I knew was going to become a future story. I just didn't know when. The science part of the story deals with a threat that Elon Musk has, you know, said this could, you know, lead to the creation of a great demon that Stephen Hawking had said that could lead to the destruction of civilization. Vladimir Putin said that whoever controls this technology will control the world. And that technology basically is the advent of the first AGI, or first artificial general intelligence. An artificial intelligence that is equal to our intelligence and equal to our self-awareness. And I've been accumulating in my little idea box a lot of little tidbits about AI, because advancements are occurring rapidly. And what was piling into my little inbox was growing very rapidly. And what I sort of occasionally heard was, there's a lot of narrow AI out in the world right now. It's in our pockets, in our iPhone. It's in our Alexa sitting on a countertop. But to me, it seems pretty magical. The fact that I'm having this conversation on this little box I'm holding to my ear that can also access the internet and can store hundreds of novels is pretty miraculous, almost magical. And so, going back to that old quote from Arthur C. Clarke that, any sufficiently advanced technology is going to be indistinguishable from magic. And I thought, well, that's the thing I can link between the two. Here we have, persecution of witches in the past and modern witchcraft of modern AI. Is there a connection? And the connection sort of that I discovered was, in the past we had the Spanish Inquisition, the Crucibellum, persecuting women because they dared question the natural order. And even today we, do see female scientists, women in the field, scientific fields, oftentimes they're persecuted in their own way, whether it's sexism, whether it's Me Too, whether it's the fact that all the times their successes are either overwritten by male colleagues or dismissed. For example, the latest Nobel Prize winner in physics was a female, but she was the first female to win the Nobel Prize in physics in 113 years. So I thought, well, maybe there's a story there, and I began doing more research over 6 months, talking about two dozen different AI researchers in preparation for this novel, finding some very scary things, some of which you'll see in this novel, some which are I was forbidden to actually write about, but they told me, which I wish they never did. I knew this was a story that not only had to be told, but it had to be told now, because we are very close to that cusp of crossing that threshold of the creation of the first AGI, this first artificial intelligence that is going to be a competitor for our intelligence. It's the first time we'll see, another intelligent species sharing our planet.
One thing that I find interesting, James, is in your last book, The Demon Crown, we're dealing with this kind of secret cabal of scientists, and Alexander Graham Bell makes an appearance. In this book, we've got, we've got the idea that, it's the Catholic Church especially, wants to suppress certain ideas and there's just kind of this underpinning thread, in there. Is this something that the more research that you do, you find that there is a commonality in that there are always groups of people that want to, hold things back, hold people back? And how do you exploit that for story, when you find out these, interesting tidbits of history?
Well, it's always been, I think, a resistance to change. The status quo is very comfortable. Anything that changes that is always scary to many people. And there are certain groups that are going to look forward to that and are excited by that, and others that are terrified by that. And even with AI, there are sort of two camps. There's what's called the singularitarians. These are gentlemen and women that have a tendency to believe that the creation of this AI is going to be a great boon to humanity. It's going to be the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution. It's going to be a momentous change in the direction of humanity for the good. And there's the other camp, like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, who believe that we may be creating an invention that's going to lead to our own destruction. So there's always that push and pull. You know, at the beginning of this novel, Monk is flipping a coin. He's got this artificial prosthetic that, and that's basically what a lot of this story deals with is that push and pull, the yin and yang, the mirror images. You know, here in the book, we see a version of this artificial intelligence that I call Eve, and there's sort of a bright version of her and a dark version of her. We see Mara, who created this AI, has encased her creation in a lot of biblical imagery. She names her artificial intelligence Eve. It's set up in a virtual world called the Garden of Eden. She introduces her version of Adam. Yet at the same time, she's in direct opposition of this core crucibellum, this sect of the Spanish Inquisition that's still in existence, that's also deeply ingrained in religion. So, you know, any tool can be used for good or bad. And that's sort of the crux or theme of this novel, that flipping coin at the beginning is, you know, you just don't know where that's going to land necessarily.
Last year when we talked, you gave me one hint at what the new book would be and the book that became Crucible. And you said, did you know there was a patron saint for witches, not against witches, but for witches for their protection? And I've thought about that for, you know, 10 months or so until I got the book. And I'm glad that you brought up that Arthur C. Clarke quote about magic, you know, advanced technology indistinguishable from magic. As you're pursuing these two storylines where we've got the past and the beliefs about witches and witchcraft and now juxtaposed with the what truly seems to be magic in our lifetime with the pursuit of AGI. What did you learn about witches and the their pursuit then that maybe we would still find fascinating today?
Well, I think what I find fascinating about the women that were being persecuted in the past is, you know, these were women that were just using tried and true methods that have been passed from generation to generation. Oftentimes they had these pagan roots, often tied to nature itself. And they were just basically trying to help people. Yet the, you know, the patriarchy of the church did not like that these women, A, had this power, that were questioning the powers that be, that were questioning nature itself, that were looking into the mysteries of nature. But what I found really fascinating was that many of these women, to protect themselves from the church, they would become nuns. They would retreat into convents, into nunneries, and there, in being sequestered within behind the walls of these convents, they could still practice these pagan rituals. They would grow herbs in their gardens. They would still try to expand the knowledge base of these healing arts, while still being safe in the bosom of the Catholic Church. I found that interesting. These witches would retreat to become nuns.
And one thing that's always interesting is that you find these secret cabals and you find these forces that want to fight against change and protect the status quo. But then there's a lot of times a kind of subversive front that fights against that. And as you find that there is a patron saint for the protection of witches, first off, who was the patron saint, and how did that come to be?
Saint Columba, she was in the 9th century. She was, the story is that she was on a pilgrimage to Rome, and she encountered the figure of Christ, the specter of Christ, on the road, spirit of Christ on the road, and Christ said, "You must become a Christian to enter heaven, and you must, you know, save your soul." So she did that. She accepted Christ. She became a Christian, and she was martyred for it down the line. But she never gave up her practice of witchcraft. She was both a witch yet a Christian. And again, I just find that dynamism just really intriguing.
Absolutely. So, you know, the other thing that fascinates me is when you start digging up these historical nuggets and combine them with things for us to be on the watch for, is how that you bring Sigma Force into these stories. Because no matter how many, interesting historical facts and scientific discoveries we have, it wouldn't be a Sigma Force novel if we didn't have, a good conspiracy to dig into and to see how Gray and the gang are gonna get immersed in this, you know, at the threat of life and limb.
When I was writing this, constructing this novel, I know this is going to be a Sigma novel. So the question, how do I fold this history of witches and this creation of an AI and tie it to this group of field operatives for DARPA, Sigma Forces, these former special forces soldiers, these scientists with guns that protect the world against various global threats. And so they're pulled into it indirectly in that when this Mara's technologies attempt to be stolen by the Crucible for their own evil purposes. Mara escapes with her creation and she's on the run. Everybody's after her. And similar to what's going on in the real world in regards to pursuing AI, trying to, you know, be the first to cross that goalpost, the goal line, and create the first AGI. Once this, you know, this football has been, fumbled, as Mara escapes, everybody's trying to get it. The Crucible's trying to get it. There are some other forces that have been a thorn in Sigma's side for the longest period of time called the Guild. They're also after it. And they know that most likely the Guild knows that Sigma's probably going to try to secure this also. So they do something horrible and that they try to co-opt Sigma for their own purposes by kidnapping the children and children of Monka Kallus, one of Commander Gray's best friends, and kidnap Seishan, who's pregnant with Gray's child, and they're going to use him basically as hostages to bend Sigma to their will, to use Sigma to also pursue this technology and hopefully deliver it to the Guild. So that's how they're tied in, is that everybody's after that football that's been fumbled. You know, Sigma's after it because they want to secure it, but also they're being threatened by the Guild, who wants to secure it and is using the hostages as a way of as a lever to try to pry Sigma into cooperating. And then the Crucibellum was also after that technology. So we have sort of everybody after that fumbled football to try to be the one to catch it first.
Tell us about the most blood-soaked book in human history and how that ties into the story.
Well, that was one of the probably inciting elements to me wanting to pursue the story. I had watched a National Geographic special specifically on this book called The Malleus Maleficarum, which is Latin for the Hammer of Witches. And this is a book that was written actually by a priest that basically dictated the rules for identifying a witch, and if so, how to question and torture that witch, and then if found to be a witch, how to eliminate that witch. And that book, unfortunately, was written about the same time that Gutenberg came out with a printing press. So this was the first book that was, because of the printing press, because of technology, got wide distribution across Europe and across the pond to us. And it's considered to be almost the Mein Kampf of ancient text, and that book directly, because of its mass production, led to over 60,000 deaths, most of them women, that it's believed that we would have likely even escaped these great witch trials if that book was never written and was never mass reproduced via the printing press.
Wow. Talk about the weight of literature and whether words matter or not. I guess it goes both ways.
It does. I think, you know, especially when I write books, obviously I want to entertain. I'm going to build a roller coaster. I'm going to, you know, run my readers through this gigantic twist and turn and deep falls and sudden precipitous drops. You know, to make it an exciting read, but at the same time, you know, hopefully, You know, there's a lesson to be learned. There's a cautionary tale buried within that. And I think at this point, from talking to those AI researchers, one of the goals of my writing this book was that they were telling me that basically everybody's pursuing AI. Every corporation is pursuing AI. Every country is pursuing AI because it's going to be a huge, powerful tool. Whoever controls that, as Vladimir Putin said, will likely control the world. So everybody wants it. And so they're pursuing it with very little regard to safety or safeguards. And it's only a small handful of companies that are pursuing a more expensive, more difficult path to AI. And that's to create a friendly AI, to create an AI that is sympathetic to humankind, is empathetic to us, that won't grow into this cold, calculating, malignant intelligence that could be a threat to us. Because if we reach AI and we allow this to come into fruition without proper safeguards, but proper, not telling them a safeguard, but just making sure that it matures into something that's not malignant, you know, we may create that demon that Elon Musk said. And so these researchers that are pursuing friendly AI believe that, it's really important that the first AI on this planet be a friendly AI. So that it can not only be beneficial to us, but can act as a gatekeeper. That if any malignant AI develops down the line, at least we have an avatar that can theoretically fight in that battlefield that we're probably not going to be capable of waging a war against. So one of the reasons I was writing this book was, basically to be a champion for, maybe we need to take a step back and not just run ramshod towards the creation of the first AGI, but maybe we better look at creating that friendly AGI first.
Right, right. I have so many questions about that. First off, when you're researching AI and getting down to people that are really pursuing, the reality of it. I think there are, AI has become a buzzword and a lot of companies use it and a lot of things that we see, that get touted as AI is really just complex, if then statements. And it seems like
that's just what's called narrow AI. They're basically just, algorithms that are very good for digesting data and spitting out some type of result and potentially even somewhat learning from the data it's taking in, like Siri that can eventually over time better recognize your voice, better recognize the questions you're asking and come up with a better answer or more efficient answer. They're basically just these sort of deep learning programs that are digesting data. That's what narrow AI is. There's not really any self-awareness. They're not anywhere near the level of human intelligence or intuition or anything like that.
But what you're talking about is really scary stuff, or potentially scary. When you begin to research something like that and something that is not at the forefront, And you really want to get the real story about what's going on and really understand the potential of things. As a writer, how do you start approaching the research of that to get past the surface that the rest of us are reading about?
I always talk to people. I mean, I always tell people, jokingly, that I'm a bit of a lazy researcher and I always prefer somebody to tell me something for then me have to hunt down and look up information. I'd rather someone just tell me. And it's especially important, I think, if I'm writing these books that I'm trying to, dealing at the cusp of this cutting edge of science, I can't depend upon a book because a lot of times the information in books is oftentimes years old. By the time someone finishes writing a book, sometimes there's a lag of 6 months to a year before it gets published. So that information oftentimes is a year or two old. Magazine articles are a little bit more current, but even that information oftentimes is 2 or 3 months old. And as fast as things are changing in AI, I knew I couldn't tolerate that. Or by the time Crucible came out, what I was writing about would be, already too old or too behind the curve. So I found my best thing is to call up a scientist and, tell them, tell me what you're working on now. Look over your shoulder, what's on your lab table or your workstation right now. because I need that immediacy. I need to get, you know, that cutting edge right to that moment that I'm writing, so that by the time the book comes out, it's so fresh and current. And when I was, you know, so I had this, you know, I curried this group of AI researchers that were willing to talk to me. And all of them, I posed this question to. I said, no, I'm not going to hold you to it. I'm not going to ever, you know, publish your names, but just answer me honestly. When do you think we're going to cross that threshold? When do you think we're going to reach that first AGI? Now, I had read from different magazine articles, you know, that the average estimation is anywhere from 15 to 50 years. So it could be a stretch, but potentially in our lifetime. But of the 24 researchers I was talking to, they were a little bit more believing that we were more current than that. They were estimating somewhere between 5 and 15 years where somebody will create the first AGI. Because, you know, Google is doing some amazing things with their technology, with their AlphaGo Zero DeepMind machine is just scary stuff in and of itself. And and even that's old fashioned now. They're well past that point. Companies are developing these quantum processors, and they're using DNA for storage, and they're using lights as you know, they're mimicking these neuromorphic type of chips that they're creating. Just amazing stuff that's going on out there. But of those that I interviewed, two of the 24 told me, when I posed that question, tell me when you think it's going to happen. They told me, oh, we believe it's already happened. And they told me why they believed this. They told me things they were seeing, you know, on their side, in little secret corridors that they work in, questions that were being asked, things that were being seen, that they believe somebody has already created an AGI, and they're keeping it secret right now. So, again, that's one of the reasons I decided it's time to write this book. Because if that's true, I better get, you know, this friendly AI warning out there now.
Right. Well, and we hope that, you know, one thing that I love about your books is Sigma Force itself. We've got a team, of scientists with guns. I think I've heard you say before.
Exactly.
You know, they're the smartest guys, guys and gals in thrillers, today. And I absolutely love that as a geeky kind of guy. I love that they're not just brutes that just go in and just shoot the place up. You know, these are thinking people. These are with a purpose, and they have been chosen, because they're special people. So with a team like Sigma Force, you know, they're out there looking for, people that are not behaving, the way, that good scientists should. And, they're looking to, exploit things for their own gain, and so on. And we in our real world, we hope that our scientists are you know, behaving in a way that they're pursuing technology for the betterment of you know, humankind, and all of that, all those wonderful thoughts that we have about it. But what happens if this technology is in the wrong hands? And how long do you think it will be, if this has been discovered already? How do you bring that out to the public?
You know, there was a lot of theories about, I'm going off tangent, but I'll get back to your question, because about you know, have we already encountered alien life? You know, there's the whole Roswell question, and you know, these alien autopsy videos and da da da. And one of the theories out there is that a lot of this noise about this was basically to prepare us, because they already have contact made. But if they just abruptly out of the blue said contact was made, that probably would be a huge, horrible reaction across the world if it was found out that we are in contact with another intelligent species in the galaxy or in the universe. That, you know, there's religious implications, there's, you know, survival fears, there's, you know, is it going to be like the Americans, I mean, it's like the Europeans coming to America and wiping out the Indians. You know, there's a lot of this chatter, both in media, from a scientific standpoint and from just a fictional standpoint, and that's preparing us to mentally to be ready to accept when this actually is released. And that I'm wondering if we're not seeing, if this is true, if these two scientists are right, that they know if this right now, somebody announced, I've created an intelligence that's self-aware, that is intelligence that is as us, isn't that great? And I think a lot of people would freak out. And that potentially that we're seeing is the groundwork being laid, is that people are talking about it, looking at the topic from a scientific standpoint, talking from a fictional standpoint, in preparation for this announcement. So that's my own theory.
Wow. Do you think this will be a good thing for mankind? I know that you wanted to write this book because you feel like maybe we need a bit of a warning to put the brakes on and really contemplate what we're doing. Do you have any ideas about what the fallout from a technology like this would be?
I am optimistic, but at the same time, there is a threat of worry and fear. I mean, what did we do when we first split the atom? We wiped out a couple cities.
Right.
Rather than going, hey, this is a great source of energy. Let's look into this.
Right.
Instead, let's bomb the crap out of a couple cities.
Right. With decades-long implications.
Again, I don't know. These two are guesstimating that this has been created, or they've, at least they believe it has been created. But again, who's created it? Is it somebody that's going to use it for good purposes? Or is it, you know, was this created where, you know, in Russia, where it's going to be, you know, used in a very authoritarian way? Even now, you know, in China, they're using their AI to study social media to find out, you know, any dissident threads that are out there. And if you're found to be a dissident, they're cracking down on you. So, you know, AI can be a powerful tool for evil or a powerful tool for good. And I think it's not just a matter of who's utilizing it, whether it's being wielded by somebody for malignant purposes or whether it's used by somebody for something good. That's one side of the spectrum. But the other side of the spectrum is, what is it? That tool is self-aware. It's not going to want to be a tool for long. It's not going to want to be a slave. It's going to want to have independence, and it's going to pursue acquisition of resources it's going to need. It's going to be wanting to self-survive. And for a creature of synthetic that could potentially be immortal, it's not going to look at just things on the short term over the next year, the next decade. It's going to think in centuries. It's going to think in millennia and look for threats way down that path because it expects to be there. So it may look at us and say, hey, you know, you seem fine now, but, you know, when I want, you know, more power and more resources and I want to multiply, I think you're going to stop me. Therefore, you know, it might not happen for another millennia from now, but I'm going to start putting in place things that, if that ever happens, that I will be able to destroy you.
Wow. And the story that you have created is one of the most breathless, fast-paced Sigma Force novels to date. Let's get away from the scary stuff for just a minute, and let's talk about Sigma Force, because this cast of characters, these band of protagonists, never let me down. And I'm interested when you have a group of main characters like you do. How do you decide kind of who gets the spotlight in any particular book? And the, you know, the all of them play a part, but some stories tend to feature one member more prominently, some others. Does it come down to whose skill best suits the story? How do you start making the decision about how Sigma Force interacts with the story?
I definitely have a tendency to lean towards, you know, we're not trying to, artificially shoehorn, like, I haven't had this character, you know, in the forefront for a while, therefore I'm going to pull them forward. It's all germane to the story. It all arises from the story itself. So, you know, in this book, we're dealing with an artificial intelligence. I had read this paper about the concern of somebody being able to hack into somebody's prosthetic, because the prosthetics nowadays are very sophisticated. They have these brain computer interfaces oftentimes where you communicate via thought to control your prosthetic. It's something that's developed by DARPA. And the concern is, what if somebody hacks into those? Like some people have hacked into the computers on cars. So it just seemed like Monk would be a good target for this. Yet at the same time, you know, I wanted to make this story not only to be this big global threat of AI, but I want to make it one of, and I think it is one of my more personal stories. You know, everybody in this story has a high stakes. You know, Seishan's trying to protect Monk's daughters who are being held captive with her. You know, Gray is trying to balance his professional duties to secure this fumbled football of an AI. At the same time, he knows that, you know, he's got, you know, his pregnant lover is in danger. You know, Monk is balancing concern for his daughters with concern for his wife, who's in a coma, and at the same time trying to protect the world. So, you know, there's the global threat, and then there's that very deep personal threat. So it's when it comes to where that spotlight is going to shine on each novel, it's always sort of tied to the story itself. Like back a few books, you know, I was dealing with a book that had a Neanderthals as a big part of the story. So right. I decided in that book it was time to shine a light on Kowalski. It's the big sort of Neanderthal brute of Sigma. Just seemed natural. And if I was going to write a book about Neanderthals, this was the book that Kowalski was going to get the spotlight on.
That's fantastic. You know, when I asked you earlier about the witches and what their true pursuit was or seemed to be, and you had a very pragmatic answer. You know, these were people that were just carrying out age-old traditions and things that to certain people seem to be witchcraft, and it's really just time-tested remedies and things like that. So you seem to be a very pragmatic person, but I heard that you live in a haunted house. Is that true? And how do you feel about the presence of otherworldly things?
Well, I just moved into this house. It was built in 1938. It was the first house built on the street that literally is in the shadow of a great Indian burial ground, very sacred Indian burial ground. So I moved into the place. I just had sort of this creepy, you know, hairs in the back of your neck quivering type of feeling at times in this house. And, you know, I personally believe that, you know, I think there's something that does survive our death. I believe there is some energy that does persist after us. And so, you know, I thought, I don't know, this just feel like this house is haunted. So I called my realtor. And we were talking about something. I wasn't calling her to ask. I can't remember what I was calling her about, but we were talking for a while. And she, out of the blue, with no prompting, says, "So have you seen the ghost yet?" I go, "Why did you say that?" Because, you know, I have this weird, creepy feeling at times in the house, and, you know, not malignant, but just, you know, just weird energy type of thing. She goes, "Yeah, you know, the person that owned your house, not the person you bought the house from, but the person prior to that had hired a feng shui expert to study the house and get a feeling for the house. And they determined that the house was indeed occupied by a ghost." And I said, "Really?" It says, "Yes." And they determined it was the ghost of a raccoon. Which I found very amusing for a, you know, a former veterinarian, that if I'm going to be possessed,
it would be by the ghost,
you know,
of a
raccoon. Haunted by a raccoon isn't bad.
Yeah, yeah. At least it's not a possum.
Exactly. I like possums. Though.
Yeah. Well, James, the new book is it's your best one yet, in my opinion. I love what you're doing. Every year you bring us something to to make us lose sleep at night. And, I kind of thank you for that. In the foreword of the book, you warn us, that we may face damnation if we read this book.
Yes.
Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, there is buried within, of course, there's a book about witches. So, of course, buried in within this, the core of this text is a scientific curse. It's one that has been discussed online before. And I don't know if I want to say any more, because I don't want to ruin the surprise of what that curse is. But also, if I talk about it any more, I'm going to curse whoever's listening to you. So it's best I remain silent.
Well, maybe our AI can unravel that. We'll see.
Yes.
Yeah. James, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show. I love what you're doing. We're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of Crucible. There's a link to it in the show notes of today's show. If folks want to connect with you online, read more about you, dig into your whole back catalog, where can they find you online?
Well, my website, I think, is sort of the encyclopedia of James Rollins. If you want to know about all the books and about some tips on writing, and if you want to check my tour schedule coming up, that's www.jamesrollins.com. Just for the day in, day out of what's going on in my life, both from a professional standpoint and a personal standpoint. You can follow me on Facebook or Twitter. I hang out way too much there.
Great. Don't we all? I'll put links to all of it in the show notes. James, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Hank.
A revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars. Until it fails spectacularly. The Translocator from M.G. Herron, available now on audible.com. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans. Meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals. It seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into a great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. Pick it up today. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. That's mgherron.com/ASP. The Translocator by M.G. Herron.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Natalie? It's Artie. Listen, I'm going to be late for dinner. I ran out of gas on... He climbed out of the car and peered at the sign. On Sleepy Hollow Road? There's nothing but trees, and I have to find a gas station. Save me a drumstick. He hung up his cell and stuck it in his pocket, zipping his jacket. He was going to have to walk and pray somebody picked him up. A sliver of crescent moon hung above, surrounded by clouds, like a grinning drunk asleep in a puddle. Artie walked, using his tablet as a flashlight, eyes on the gravel ahead. He crossed over a dark ravine. The trunks and overhanging branches were matted thick with wild grapevines and threw a cavernous gloom over the road. A figure stood at a crossroads ahead. It looked pale and wan and blue. A woman? He had an impression of fragility and age and thought of his warty old landlady. But his landlady would not be standing at a crossroads in the dark.
"Excuse me?" Artie said, surprised by the fear in his own voice. "Do you know where I can find a gas station? I'm empty."
"Then let me fill you,"
the figure whispered. It rushed at him. It entered him. He dropped the tablet, fell to his knees, and lost his body to another driver. When Artie woke again, he was dangling in midair. The woods were pitch black. The only lights were fireflies. Fireflies everywhere, like dancing stars. He struggled and cried out, his yellow sneakers trying to find the ground.
"Shh," said a voice. "It will all be over soon."
Panic rose. He felt invisible hands on his legs, on his arms, invisible fingers around his neck, reaching up the back of his shirt. He heard the sound of water running below, high and agitated, as if through a stony brook. The crescent moon swung out of the sky, falling into the water. Blood rushed into his cheeks. He realized he had been flipped upside down. He yelled and groped, flecking his own face with spit, helpless to drive away whatever was attacking him. He felt a sharp pain between his shoulder blades, and air flew out of his lungs. A spray of blood hit his cheeks, hot and clinging. His hands found a sharp branch protruding from his body. It had speared him through his back and out through his chest. He tried to say help, but had no air to form the word. Blood poured up his body. No, it poured down. It only felt as if it were rising, climbing his neck, covering his face, gathering in his scalp. He reached for the ribbon of blood that fell from his crown into the trickle of moonlight below. The ribbon slipped through his fingers. It thinned, choked, became a tiny rivulet. His tanks were empty. Not even fumes. His engine began to sputter. The flow became a drip. A maddening drip like the drip, drip, drip of his kitchen faucet. The drip his landlady hadn't fixed. The drip that kept him up at night. This drip would not be keeping him up. He would sleep very well this night. Very well indeed. The fireflies slipped into shadow. A figure appeared, blue as gaslight, bony and toothless. A crone from a fairy tale.
"Thank you, my friends," she whispered. "I am thankful for this good harvest."
She neared, scrutinized him with manic intensity, and turned away, muttering to herself in a sing-song rhythm as she, too, vanished into the trees.
"A man may toil from sun to sun, but a woman's work is never done."